Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Friday, May 3rd. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Rachel. And we start on the front page of the Quad City Times article, Human Dignity Will Prevail. This written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Immigrant advocates rally against new Iowa law. Davenport advocates for Latino and immigrant communities and faith leaders gathered at St. Anthony's Catholic Church Wednesday to oppose a recent Iowa law that makes illegal immigration a state crime. Under Senate File 2340, Iowa law enforcement would be allowed to arrest and judges would be able to order the removal of an immigrant who re-entered the United States illegally. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed the bill April 10th. The law is currently on hold as a similar law in Texas was stayed by a judge. In addition to Davenport, Latino community advocacy groups held vigils in Iowa City, Waterloo, and Des Moines to protest the bill Wednesday. Opponents of the bill are concerned the law will lead to racial profiling, mistaken arrests, and dehumanizes immigrants, documented and undocumented. Legislative measures such as the recent Iowa bill, Senate File 2340, which is disproportionately punitive in nature and does not provide for any viable solutions for residents without legal status, Father Rudy Juarez said. The deputizing of state and local officials to prosecute individuals for state immigration crimes comes without funding. One in two, lack of training of public officials runs the risk of racial profiling and legal challenges. Juarez called on elected officials to enact meaningful immigration reform that identifies and prevents entry of terrorists and dangerous criminals, but which protects human rights and the dignity of all persons involved. Iowa Republicans argued the state needed to act to respond to record numbers of illegal border crossings under President Joe Biden, whom they accuse of failing to secure the border. We're a country of laws, and these are illegal immigrants that have illegally entered our country, and if they've been denied or if they've been deported and they're back in and we've made it a state crime, Iowa Governor Reynolds said at a news conference Wednesday. Reynolds called on Congress to pass laws to streamline and expedite the legal immigration process. I have a responsibility to protect the health and safety of the citizens of this state, and I'm going to do whatever I can to implement that, especially because I have a president that could care less about really doing his constitutional duty to protect our sovereignty, Reynolds said. Under the bill, someone arrested for illegal entry by Iowa law enforcement could be charged with a Class D or Class C felony, which carry prison sentences up to 5 or 10 years, respectively. During court proceedings, a judge could issue an order to a person charged to require them to return to their country of origin. Law enforcement would not be able to arrest a person for violating the new law while at a school, a place of religious worship, health care facility, or a facility that provides forensic medical exams for survivors of sexual assault. The bill also creates civil immunity for city and state employees and contractors who may be sued for implementing the law. Daniel Salazar, the state director of the League of Latin American Citizens, told the Davenport audience of about 100, the vigil's purpose was threefold: to send a clear message to elected officials that Latino and immigrant communities and allies were paying attention, to affirm commitment to collaboration with law enforcement and legislators to enact just immigration law, and to call on legislators to repeal Senate File 2340, push for immigration reform, and treat immigrants with dignity and respect. The event, held on the lawn of the Davenport Catholic Church, Juarez said was established to serve immigrants in 1837, featured faith and Latino community leader speeches interspersed with choir songs and prayers. First of all, Iowa has no business passing legislation that is and has always been under the purview of our federal government, Pastor Rich Hendricks said. In fact, we all know that this law is part of a larger pattern that seeks to demonize and dehumanize undocumented Iowans. Hendricks said he believed the law puts children of migrants at great risk for separation and gives a green light for law enforcement to harass individual Iowans. Under the law, a person who is convicted of illegal reentry cannot be considered for a deferred judgment or a deferred sentence. Hendricks criticized that provision, as well as that it would cost Iowa law enforcement time and resources to transport people to their country of origin. Laney Gonzalez, a St. Ambrose University student, told the audience, "Human dignity will prevail. We are not afraid. No tenemos miedo," Gonzalez said. "We will not allow legalized racial profiling through this unfunded mandate. Instead, we will continue to demand what we have been asking for decades, comprehensive immigration reform." Mike Guster, the president of the Davenport Metrocom NAACP, read a statement sent by Davenport Police Chief Jeff Bladell to LULAC about the bill. Bladell wrote April 29th that because of litigation in another state, there has been no guidance or direction from our state on enforcing the new law, and we do not anticipate decisions being made anytime soon. "I want to reassure you that despite the uncertainty surrounding the bill, our commitment to ensuring public safety and security for all residents, regardless of immigration status, remains unwavering. Immigration status has never been a determining factor in how law enforcement resources are allocated or utilized within our department. We maintain a steadfast position on this matter and continue to uphold policies that promote fairness and impartiality in our law enforcement practices."
Hope for Peace and Understanding is the next article on the front page. Augie and WIU leaders talk nationwide campus protests. This is also by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. Quad City's colleges and university leaders note the importance of balancing campus speech with civility as student-led protests continue to gain momentum across the globe. Campus protests over the war in Gaza have swept the nation since April, notably following the arrests of Columbia University student demonstrators. Many students are demanding that their institutions and the United States government divest from any companies or partners who are advancing Israel's military attacks in Gaza. There also have been subsequent pro-Israel counter-protests. "We know these are turbulent times for many college campuses and that some individuals are heartened by protesters while it invokes fear for others," said Augustana College President Andrea Talentino. "Our hearts are with those in the Middle East living through war and with those living in the Quad Cities and elsewhere nationwide who are impacted in their own ways, she added. We hope for peace and understanding for all people, near and far. While there haven't been any local campus protests on the issue in recent weeks, a group of students at Illinois State University called Students for Justice in Palestine, ISU, set up an encampment Tuesday on the campus quad. Since ISU policy bars students from construction structures on campus grounds without prior approval, the university asked demonstrators to take down their tents or face consequences such as academic sanctions. Students took down the encampment by Wednesday afternoon. Students at the University of Iowa and Iowa State University, two of Iowa's three public regent schools, also have held pro-Palestinian protests along with Drake University. The Iowa City Students for Justice in Palestine scheduled a three-day gathering this weekend featuring presentations from Iowans for Palestine and Jewish Voices for Peace members. Talentino said the community principles guiding Augustana College's campus strive for civil community dialogue and self-expression, emphasizing, quote, the responsibility and care each member should have in their words and actions, end quote. She continued, Augustana's community does not stand for intolerance or discrimination. Our social conduct code includes guidance for prioritizing safety and well-being, and resources for living and working on a campus that welcomes free expression. Augustana's social conduct code's list of prohibited conduct includes intentional disruption or otherwise obstruction to teaching and learning, research, administrative, and disciplinary proceedings, or other college-related activities. The list also included disorderly or indecent conduct and failure to comply with these decisions or requests from college officials or a campus judicial body. Similarly, St. Ambrose University's student handbook prohibits participating in the creation of any action that disrupts the orderly processes of St. Ambrose University by any means, including any attempt to obstruct or deny access to campus facilities, services, or programs extending to those who incite others to do so. St. Ambrose University did not respond to repeated requests over 2 days for comment for this story. At Western Illinois University, a public institution, all campus grounds are considered a free speech area, said university spokeswoman Alicia Looney, especially at the Macomb campus's University Union. Any demonstrations are permitted on university premises as long as they do not disrupt the academic experience or threaten the safety of students and staff, she said. While corrective measures vary, Augustana would address any campus activities violating the social conduct code through its Dean of Students office. Per the code, Talentino said, the college will not intervene to regulate the content of protests and demonstrations. At the same time, the college will not make the campus available to or otherwise support activities or groups that promote hate and violence towards individuals or groups or that violate the college's discrimination and harassment policies. Augustana rejects violence of all kinds, Talentino said, and both encourages and supports opportunities for respectful discourse. We know we are stronger by working together to navigate a changing world and grapple with complicated issues, Talentino added.
Thanks, Rachel. And we have another article on the front page here. More proud of budget tax cuts. Iowa legislators passed $8.9 billion budget. This written by Caleb McCullough of the Quad City Times. Gary Moore is a Republican who resides in Bettendorf and represents House District 93. He is a retired higher education administrator and is serving his fourth term in the Iowa House. He is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Moore is up for re-election in November, challenged by Democrat Mindy Smith Pace. Last year, Moore said he was happy the legislature was able to secure funding for a high-risk unit in his judicial district and for a $22 million DOT maintenance facility in Davenport. Read his thoughts on this year's session below. Key votes. Area Education Agency overhaul, no. Income tax cut, yes. Illegal immigration enforcement, yes. Allowing school staff to carry guns, yes. Postpartum Medicaid extension, yes. Bills sponsored or worked on. House File 2539. Strengthening the penalties for violating open meetings laws, which passed. Successes of the session. The success of this legislative session, from my standpoint as House Appropriations Chairman, is creating an $8.9 billion budget that spends $2 billion less than what we take in. In addition, all our savings accounts are full and we'll have $3.7 billion in the Taxpayer Relief Fund. In addition to funding government for another year, we have money left over to speed up tax cuts for Iowans to a flat 3.8% in 2025 instead of 3.9% in 2026. Disappointments from the session. I really don't have any, as I think it was a highly successful session for Iowans.
Continuing with local news, defendants file an appeal seeking to be dismissed from consolidated collapse lawsuit. This is written by Tom Lowy of the Quad City Times and Sarah Watson, also of the Times. Three of the defendants in the lawsuits brought by the residents and families of those who lived in a collapsed downtown Davenport building have appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. The City of Davenport, its Neighborhood Services Director and former Chief Building Official, filed the appeal April 30th, seeking to be dismissed from a consolidated lawsuit brought in the wake of the May 28th collapse of 324 Main Street in downtown Davenport. The suits have been partially consolidated to streamline various court processes as they progress. The appeal follows the April 5th decision by District Court Judge Mark Lawson that rejected the city's legal effort to have city former chief building official Trishna Pradhan and Director of Development and Neighborhood Services Rich Oswalt removed from the lawsuits. Lawson did approve dismissing former city administrator Corey Spiegel as a defendant in the lawsuits. The city argued in its motion to dismiss that neither the city nor its employees owed a duty to the tenants of 324 Main. The city's attorneys also argued the city and its employees are shielded from liability under qualified immunity because the law creating alleged liability was not clearly understood. Lawson rejected both arguments, finding legal precedent in Iowa that could lead to a finding of liability against the city, Pradhan, and Oswalt. The appeal filed by Jason O'Rourke of law firm Lane and Waterman addresses only the decision denying qualified immunity. O'Rourke is arguing the city, Pradhan, and Oswalt are immune from prosecution. Qualified immunity has been a controversial legal topic in the state since Iowa introduced it in 2021. In many cases, qualified immunity was intended to make it more difficult for citizens who have been injured in some way to bring suit for monetary damages against cities, municipalities, and local government or state agencies. The partial collapse on May 28th killed three men, caused a woman to lose her leg and led dozens of residents to lose their homes and possessions. In the 11 months since, families and residents brought a number of lawsuits against the city, several city officials, the building's owner, and companies that did repair work to the building. The plaintiffs argued the city, Pradhan, and Oswald failed to use reasonable care in conducting inspections and failed to post notices to vacate 324 Main. In rejecting the argument from the city, Lawson cited a 1979 case called Wilson versus Nepstead. In that case, following a fire in a Des Moines apartment building, tenants claimed that certain statutes, ordinances, and building codes required the city of Des Moines to perform inspections and compel compliance, and that the city was negligent in performing or failing to perform those duties. The Iowa Supreme Court concluded that the city did, in fact, owe a duty to the people injured in the fire because the city had inspected the apartment building the residents lived in. Lawson wrote the city of Davenport, Pradhan, and Oswald had a duty to conduct their inspections using a reasonable degree of care, including at 324 Main. As an example for this case, Lawson noted that on March 9th, Pradhan ordered the stoppage of wall repairs because they didn't meet city design codes, showing she had the authority to halt construction and act in a supervisory role. These ordinances impose upon city employees the authority and duty to require corrections of the defects and to warn tenants in the event the building is ordered to be vacated, the judge wrote. The plaintiffs allege that both Pradhan and Oswald failed to serve and post the required notices. The city also argued in its motion to dismiss that neither the city nor its employees owed a duty to the tenants of 324 Main. Lawson rejected that argument, writing, "With the exception of Defendant Spiegel, I can draw a reasonable inference from the allegations that each of the other city defendants is potentially liable. Municipal employees owe a duty of care to tenants of an apartment building under certain circumstances."
Thanks, Rachel. And we have an article written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Billboard lights could be limited. Lane and Waterman to provide legal counsel to city. Lane and Waterman will provide legal counsel to the Davenport City Council in the near term. Davenport's interim city attorney, Brian Heyer, retired Wednesday. Until a new city attorney is named, interim city administrator Mallory Merritt said Lane and Waterman will provide legal counsel to the council and handle routine city legal cases, such as prosecuting municipal infractions. Merritt said the firm will assume near-term temporary legal services under the existing retainer, which will be amended. Merritt said a contract will come before the City Council for the second cycle in May for $30,000 a month. She received one other proposal from firm Hopkins and Huebner for $90,000 a month. A moratorium on the construction of new billboards is set to expire June 13th, with new city guidelines in place for how bright, how close, and how big electronic billboards can be. Existing billboards would be grandfathered in. At-large aide alderman Kyle Gripp said he and 6th Ward alderman Ben Jobgen started getting complaints from residents about the brightness of new billboards on 53rd Street, which prompted the introduction of the billboard moratorium and a call for the city to research and adjust its policies for where and how bright billboards could be. The new rules, if passed, would prohibit electronic billboards in commercial corridors zoned C2, require they be separated by a minimum of 3,000 feet twice the distance of static billboards, limit the sign area to a maximum of 400 square feet, and require they be at least 600 feet from a residential district, four times the distance of static billboards. The city's new ordinance would also limit the maximum brightness to 5,000 nits during the day and 200 nits between dusk and dawn. Nits measure luminance, or the amount of light emitted from an object. Development and Planning Administrator Laura Berkeley said the measurement is in line with recommendations from the Illuminating Engineering Society. The ordinance must be passed three times, which would happen over the course of the next 5 weeks.
And a couple of very short pieces. Thompson on Lockdown for a Suspected Gun. This by Joshua Shimkus of the Quad City Times. Visiting at Federal Correctional Institution, Thompson remained suspended as of Thursday morning as the Federal Bureau of Prisons investigates whether a firearm was introduced into the facility. A spokesman for the Federal Bureau of Prisons said that they received the information that a firearm may have been introduced to the prison on Thursday, April 25th. The spokesman said the Bureau immediately put the facility on lockdown status to protect the public, employees, and individuals in our custody until a comprehensive search could be completed. Visits are not allowed during lockdowns. The spokesman could not discuss specifics and gave no indication on when they expected the lockdown to end. Senator Dick Durbin says Quad City passenger rail needs to be prioritized. This also by Joshua Shimkus. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin met with the Federal Railroad Administrator Tuesday, asking him to prioritize a proposed passenger rail connection between Chicago and the Quad Cities. According to a press release from his office, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, met with Federal Railroad Administrator Amit Bose on Tuesday to receive an update on the Chicago Quad Cities passenger rail project. Durbin said, "Our state relies on rail. It fuels our economy and ensures connectivity across our vast state. Today, in meeting with Federal Railroad Administrator Amit Bose, I urged him to prioritize the project and follow through on the federal funding that was allocated to establish the rail line." The project has had access to $225 million in state funding since 2019. But the Illinois Department of Transportation and Iowa Interstate have been unable to reach an agreement on the infrastructure upgrades for the project. Federal funding, first secured in 2010 and extended multiple times, is set to expire in December unless they can reach an agreement and begin construction. And then this from Olivia Allen, John Deere Planetarium hosting free open house. Augustana College's John Deere Planetarium will host its annual spring open house on Saturday from 8:30 to 10 p.m., free and open to the public. The evening will include a planetarium show, along with indoor and outdoor programs led by Planetarium Director Lee Karkner. Attendees will have an opportunity to visit the Carl Gamble Observatory and can expect to see a detailed glimpse of the moon via Auggie's telescopes. The planetarium and observatory are located on Auggie's campus at 820 38th Street in Rock Island. The Getz Rogers Gallery, displaying a quarter-ton piece of the Canyon Diablo meteor and other celestial images, will also be open to the public. The Frixel Geology Museum will also be open. The Frixel Museum features one of the top mineral and fossil collections in the Midwest, located next to the planetarium in Swenson Hall of Geosciences. Visitors can expect to see glowing fluorescent rocks, casts of a Tyrannosaurus rex skull, and a complete 22-foot-long I'm sorry, this is very difficult to pronounce, Cryolophosaurus dinosaur skeleton. Those attending Saturday's event should dress according to the weather, as planetarium observing areas are unheated. Telescope views may be possible if sky conditions are cloudy, but indoor programming will remain available. And a reminder, you're listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time now to turn to today's obituaries. There are three obituaries and several pendings. I'll read the pendings and one obituary, Jim, if you'll take the other two. So services or arrangements pending include Doris J. Wendt, age 91, of Davenport, who died Wednesday, May 1st. Arrangements pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home in Rock Island. Donald or Roz Allen Rosenow, age 89, of Tipton, died April 30th. Arrangements pending with Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Linda K. Randall, age 68, of Galesburg, died Thursday, May 2nd. Arrangements directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and Direct Burial of Moline. Duane R. Miller, age 81, resident of Eldridge, died on Wednesday, May 1st. Arrangements are pending at Chambers Funeral Home in Eldridge. Clayton D. Evans of Aledo, Illinois, died May 1st. Arrangements pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematorium of Rock Island. Kevin Wright, age 53, of Rock Island, died Thursday, April 18th. Cremation is directed by the Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. And Jennifer M. Johnson, age 29, of East Moline, died Thursday, May 2nd. Arrangements are with the Van Hoe Funeral Home of East Moline. Then this very brief obituary for Suzanne A. York. Funeral services for Suzanne A. York, age 77, of Davenport, will be 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th, at the Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. Burial will be in the Rock Island National Cemetery, Arsenal Island. Visitation will be Monday from 4 until 6 p.m. at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the Columbus Club or Catholic Service Board. Sue died Wednesday, May 1st, at the Call Home, surrounded by her family. Among survivors are her husband, Steve, of Davenport. To view the complete obituary, visit the hmdfuneralhome.com.
And we have Bruce Michael Summers, 65, of Cottleville, Missouri, formerly of Bettendorf, passed away on April 28th at Evelyn's House Hospice Facility in Creve Coeur, Missouri, after a courageous two-year battle with cholangiocarcinoma. Bruce was born on July 30th, 1958, in Panna, Illinois. He was a dedicated family man, survived by his wife, Christine, son Scott, girlfriend Joanne Tang, brother Jeff, spouse Debbie Summers, sisters-in-law Connie Summers and Michelle, spouse Lon Rausch, nephews Staten, spouse Bonnie Summers, and Harrison, girlfriend Brittany Johnson Summers. In his career, Bruce worked for Navy Brand Manufacturing for 25 years as a sales representative, served as a volunteer lieutenant on the Bettendorf Fire Department for 12 years, and most recently worked for Farm and Home Supply in Cottleville, Missouri. He loved helping customers and working with his team members. Bruce enjoyed cruising the Caribbean and was passionate about yard work, always having the greenest lawn on the block. He always cherished spending time with family and friends. Bruce will always be remembered for his gentle smile, his elaborate storytelling, and his witty sense of humor. Consistent with Bruce's wishes, a service will not be held, and the date for a future celebration of life will be determined. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to Siteman Cancer Center or Evelyn's House General Support in honor of Bruce. And then we have Jeffrey D. Coutts, 62, of Moline, passed away April 29th at his home, surrounded by family. A mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th at Sacred Heart Church in Moline. Visitation will be 3:30 to 7 p.m. Monday at Rafferty Funeral Home, 2111 First Street A, Moline, with a rosary at 2:45 p.m. Burial will be at Rock Island Memorial Park Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made to Seton School or Alleman High School. Jeff was born June 14, 1961, in Davenport, the son of Carl and Beverly Schoonhoven Coutts, Jr. He married Julie Ressler on June 8, 1985, at Sacred Heart Church, Moline. Jeff was an Alleman High School graduate and then graduated from St. Ambrose University, where he earned his B.S. in business. He made a lot of lifelong friends and memories at the Blue House. Shortly after college, he began his career at Bi-State Packaging in Milan, which became Group-O Milan for 40 years, where his co-workers became family. The Coutts family is so appreciative of the generosity and support they showed them, especially throughout the last 4 years. Jeff was a lifelong member of Sacred Heart Church, Moline, longtime member of Oakwood Country Club, Coal Valley, where he enjoyed countless rounds of golf and was a past board member of Crime Stoppers. He and Julie were co-president of Alleman Booster Club. Jeff was a diehard Green Bay Packer fan, where he was a season ticket holder. He was also a St. Louis Cardinal fan, avid golfer, and loved traveling, skiing, going to see live music, and enjoyed a good craft beer with friends and family. Jeff's battle was long, but he never gave up and never complained, despite the obstacles he faced. He knew he had an incredibly strong support system around him and a lot of prayer warriors. His family is forever grateful for the love and support that has been shown. Survivors include his wife, Julie, children, Matthew Coutts, Moline, and Emily, spouse, Zachary Sargent, Bloomington, Illinois, a sister, Carol, spouse, James Neiman, of Sterling, Illinois, and brothers, Stephen, spouse Deborah Coutts, East Moline, Thomas, spouse Elizabeth Coutts, Arlington, Texas, Joseph, spouse Lynn Coutts, Cleveland, Tennessee, brother-in-law Mike, spouse Kim Ressler, Rock Island, Illinois. He was preceded in death by his infant sister, Mary Ann. His family would like to thank Hospice Compassion, Dr. David Dingley at the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Costas L. Constantinou, and his staff at the Unity Point Cancer Center in Moline for all the compassionate care he received throughout his treatment of multiple myeloma cancer. Condolences may be left at www.raffertyfunerals.com. And just a note, some of you probably remember Duane Eddy, twangy guitar hero of early rock, and he died recently at age 86.
It's time to go to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. There are two opinion pieces besides the editorial board pieces. I'm going to start with the editorial board pieces. Your favorite teachers, Timeless Tickets does the 90s starting Monday. Entertainment reporter Gannon Hannevold's concert series, Timeless Tickets, starts back up Monday. The series, which began in February, aims to find the most notable concert from every year in the Quad Cities from 1960 to 2023. So far, Gannon has done the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Here's a compilation of the best concerts each year from 1960 to 1989. The 80s included a wide range of performers, from Willie Nelson to Prince to Ozzy Osbourne to Kenny G. The 90s series will run 10 days straight with a concert per year each day through May 15th. If you have a photo or a story to share from an iconic local show, send it to entertainment reporter Gannon Hannevold at ghannevold@qctimes.com. Award-winning education reporter Olivia Allen will begin a weekly education column published on Mondays. Traditionally, newspaper coverage of schools focuses heavily on school boards and administration. We'd like to change that a little and add more information about students, teachers, and programs. We'll still cover the big issues in school boards across Quad Cities, but this column will provide a mix of educational items. Olivia's first column on Monday will be about one of her favorite teachers. In advance of National Teachers Appreciation Week, May 6th through 10th, I asked readers for blurbs about favorite teachers. Here are the responses, thanks to all who took the time to submit these. Okay, this is from Robert Woolley of Muscatine. Favorite teacher, Jesse Leonard Stratton. What class, where? Excelsior, grades 1 through 8, Taylor Ridge. First of all, I must tell you all that I grew up on a small farm in the 40s. There was a lot of things to learn on their farm. I started my schooling as a six-year-old. First through eighth grades, my teacher was Jesse Leonard Stratton, a World War II veteran. He was stern, honest, and kind. We had only a very small library, but he would find books for us. I tested in my seventh grade at a high school sophomore level. Thank you, Jesse Leonard Stratton. The next favorite teacher was submitted by Rebecca Andreessen Weiss of Davenport. Her favorite teacher was Mrs. Knight. What class and where? Sixth grade, Grant Elementary School in Davenport. What made this teacher stand out? Mrs. Knight lived up to her reputation of being strict and demanding. She challenged us to new heights of classroom performance as to manners, conduct, and academic performance. We became better classroom citizens and learned how to learn. We complained about her constantly. Many did not appreciate her methods, yet her teachings profoundly impacted and enhanced my entire educational and professional career. My biggest regret is that I never returned to Grant to thank her. And I'm going to skip ahead to the last two. This submitted by Nick Camlin of Rock Island. Favorite teacher, Mrs. Enders. What class and where? Kindergarten, Denkman Elementary, Rock Island. What made this teacher stand out? Mrs. Enders was my first formal teacher and continues to be the teacher I think of first and foremost in my upbringing and schooling. She played the piano and we sang in class. The new things she taught us was done with care and experience. Mrs. Enders lived on a farm and we made our own butter and ice cream in school. It was extraordinarily mind-opening as I look back. Mrs. Enders encouraged my fascinations in presidents, drawing, and architecture. She shaped me to value content of character by teaching about Martin Luther King and the dream he had for his children. I'll never forget AM Kindergarten in Room 2. And finally, this from Bill Todd of Lafayette. Favorite teacher, Mrs. Lois Nicholson, who is deceased. What class and where? Fifth and sixth grade, Lafayette Public Schools, which closed in 1971. What made this teacher stand out? Early on, I had a hard time learning to read. Once I caught on, I read a lot of books in Mrs. Nicholson's class. Each room in those days had a small library, so I asked her if I could go into the 7th, 8th grade room and find more books to read, and I did. The best part of this is that in 2005, I was visiting a nursing home, and who was there in a wheelchair but Mrs. Nicholson? We visited, pushing her during other visits, and I told her that neither of us would have ever thought that in our golden years we would meet and I would be helping my fifth, sixth grade teacher get around. On my last visit, Mrs. Nicholson was having trouble hanging up a towel. I helped her and said goodbye. Mrs. Nicholson died the next day. I am 83 years old, and I spent 38 years as a teacher.
Thank you, Rachel. Hats off to teachers. Here's an opinion written by Rachel Cohen. She's a senior policy reporter at Vox who focuses on U.S. social policy. And her column is syndicated by Tribune Content Agency. States are finally stepping up on housing. For years, the easiest thing to do about building new housing was nothing. The federal government largely deferred to state and local governments on matters of land use, and states mostly deferred to local governments, which typically defer to their home-owning constituents who back restrictive zoning laws that bar new construction. That's slowly changing as the housing supply crisis ripples across the country. Experts say the U.S. is short somewhere between 3.8 and 6.8 million homes, and most renters feel priced out of the idea of home ownership altogether. The lack of affordable housing is causing homelessness to rise. In Washington, D.C., Congress has held more hearings on housing affordability recently than it has in decades, and President Joe Biden has been ramping up attention on the housing crisis, promising to build, and to bring housing costs down for good. But it's all at the state level where some of the most consequential change is taking place. Over the last 5 years, Republican and Democratic legislators and governors in a slew of states have looked to update zoning codes, transform residential planning processes, and improve home building and design requirements. Some states that have stepped up include Oregon, Florida, Montana, and California, as well as states like Utah and Washington. This year, Maryland, New York, and New Jersey passed state-level housing legislation, and Colorado may soon follow suit. Not all state-level bills have been equally ambitious in addressing the supply crisis, and not all states have been successful at passing new laws, especially on their first few tries. And some states have succeeded in passing housing reform 1 year, only to strike out with additional bills the next. Real housing reform requires iterative and sustained legislative attention. It almost never succeeds with just one bill signing. Partly due to pressure from voters and from more organized pro-housing activists, legislative trends are starting to emerge. More states and housing experts are thinking not only about passing laws to boost housing production, but also about how to enforce those laws, close loopholes, and demand compliance. As researchers with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis outlined last fall, some states are now looking to increase housing production by enabling more multifamily housing and accessory dwelling units, ADUs, to be built without having developers first seek approval from local planning agencies or elected boards. This accelerated construction process is known as building by right. For example, Oregon passed a law in 2019 allowing fourplexes, a multifamily home that typically houses four families under one roof, to be built anywhere in large cities and for duplexes to be built anywhere in mid-sized cities. Before, a developer would have needed to seek special permission to build such housing. Under pressure to do something about the housing crisis, some state lawmakers are advancing bills that allow politicians to claim they're taking action, although the legislation itself is weak and unlikely to make big dents on the various problems. Some bills may even make affordability issues worse over the long term. For example, after failing to pass housing reform last year, lawmakers in New York came together again this year to push something through Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul and her allies in the state legislature are cheering their recently agreed upon housing package, which includes tenant protections and incentives to spur new construction. But experts and activists say it lacks real ambitious zoning and production measures and will be unlikely to drive new affordability. Passing legislation for housing reform on the state level is often just the first step, as opponents then sometimes seek to challenge the new laws in court or localities search for loopholes or other ways to avoid compliance. Sometimes lawmakers water down housing production mandates and other enforcement mechanisms before the bills even pass through the legislature. Housing experts with the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy say it's likely to take at least 3 to 5 years after a statewide policy is passed before the public should expect to see any real changes in housing production. And they urge patience before claiming a reform has failed or succeeded. Many of the ambitious state housing policies that have been adopted are still in the early stages of implementation, so we don't yet have definite evidence about what works and what doesn't. They wrote in September, without realistic expectations about this time frame, pro-housing advocates may get discouraged while opponents claim that zoning changes are ineffective, all before the policies have kicked in.
We have a few minutes for sports. What to watch in the days ahead as far as baseball goes. Chicago Cubs versus the Brewers for today at 1:20, tomorrow at 1:20, and Sunday at 1:20. The Cardinals versus the White Sox today in the evening and Saturday and Sunday at 1:15. The Chicago White Sox today at 7:15 versus the Cardinals, as I just said. The Quad City Steam Wheelers at Iowa, Saturday at 7:05, at Sioux Falls on May 10th at 7:05, and versus Iowa on May 17th at 7:05, and the Quad Cities River Bandits at Beloit for today and the rest of the weekend, today at 6:35 and Saturday and Sunday at 1:05. On TV, college baseball, Texas A&M at LSU at 7 o'clock on SECN. College softball, 4 o'clock Indiana at Northwestern on BTN. 5 o'clock Oregon State at Cal on the Pac-12 network. At 5, Alabama at Auburn, SEC network. At 6, Nebraska at Minnesota on BTN. At 6:30, Oklahoma State at Oklahoma on Fox Sports 1. Major League Baseball at 1 o'clock, Milwaukee at the Cubs on Marquee Network. At 7:15, the White Sox at St. Louis on NBC Sports Channel. At 6 o'clock, the LA Angels at Cleveland on MLBN. And 9 o'clock, Atlanta at LA Dodgers on MLBN. The NBA playoffs, Game 6, Cleveland at Orlando at 6 o'clock on ESPN. And at 8:30, Game 6, the LA Clippers at Dallas. And then just a couple of minutes. So this is kind of interesting. On this date, May 3rd, this is history. 1902, May 3rd, 1902, Ellen Adale wins the Kentucky Derby by a nose over Inventor, giving jockey Jimmy Winkfield his second straight Derby victory. Winkfield is the last black rider to win the Kentucky Derby. In 1952, on May 3rd, CBS is the first network to televise the Kentucky Derby, with Hill Gale winning by 2 lengths over Sub Fleet. Jockey Eddie Arcaro wins a record 5th Derby, and Ben Jones wins a record 6th for a trainer. On this date in 1979, Major League Baseball Cleveland Indian Bobby Bonds hits his 300th home run. He was the second to have 300 home runs and 300 stolen bases. In 1981, on May 3rd, the Boston Celtics wipe out an 11-point deficit in the second half to beat Philadelphia 91-90 in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals and become the fourth NBA team to recover from a 3-1 deficit. On this date in 1992, New York Met Eddie Murray is the 24th to hit 400 home runs. And on this date in 2008, Big Brown, ridden by Kent Desormeaux, scores a 4 3/4 length victory in the Kentucky Derby. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.